You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I've been doing this since 2009, thanks to the donations and support of listeners like you. Today, we're coming to the end. I don't know what date it is. It's like the 26th or something of August 2020. Thank God, coming to the end of the horrible season of summer. And I want to talk about something. The paper that I wrote, I don't know if I published this or not, I probably did. It's called The Heart of the Matter: Why Do Jewish Elites Hate Europeans? Or, alternatively, hate white people. What is the problem here? What is the fundamental divide? Let me start off by citing Tacitus in his Roman history. He's talking about the Provincia Judea, and he says, "The practices of the Jews are malevolent and despicable, and they've entrenched themselves by their very degeneracy. Deviants of the most depraved kind, who had no use for the religion of their predecessors, they took to collecting dues and contributions in order to swell the Jewish treasury. Another reason for their increasing wealth may be found in their unrelenting loyalty and eager nepotism towards other Jews. But all the rest of the world they hold in contempt, with the hatred reserved for enemies. They will not feed or intermarry with Gentiles. Despite being overtly lustful as a race, the Jews shun carnal dealings with women foreign to their tribe. Among their own kind, however, nothing is forbidden. They have adopted a practice of circumcision to show that they are different from others. Those seeking to convert to Judaism adopt the same practices, and the very first lesson they're taught is to despise the gods, shed all feelings of patriotism, and consider parents, children, and brothers as readily expendable. However, Jews make certain that their population increases." Let's be clear here. Today, you know, Westerners, especially Americans, have no idea how to think. Thinking logically, going from point A to point B to point C into a conclusion, is not easy. It's actually quite difficult. You have to get rid of all heteronymous elements. Freedom and reason are two sides of the same coin. Things like self-interest or pride, envy, have to be cast aside, or else you can't come to the proper conclusion. It's now become a major pet peeve when someone will say in a debate, "You're critical of Jews in media or academia, whatever it is, therefore you must hate my friend who's Jewish." First of all, using the word hate, of course, is loaded, and often doesn't make a lot of sense. No one hates someone for no reason. It's never happened before. But that's a common thing to say. It shows a complete lack of any understanding of cognition. We're not referring to individuals, because really, individuals don't make any difference. Unless you're Warren Buffett, it doesn't matter. We're talking about groups. We're talking about social forces. We're talking about social movements. We're not talking about the individuals necessarily that make them up. This is often too much for the average American to understand. So you're critical of Jews, or you're critical of Black Americans in some respect, and therefore you must hate your Jewish neighbor. And the only answer really to that is, I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking about groups. So when we talk about Jewish elites We're talking about the a social movement, a social force, Jewish America or world Jewry, whatever word you want to attach to it. Most of us have known many good Jews on a personal level. One has nothing to do with the other. We're talking about two different levels. A social movement and an individual are extremely different from one another. The fact that the average person can't keep that straight should tell you pretty much everything you need to know about how they must think. Anyway, Tacitus is again referring to the Jews as a tribe. Everything that the ancients said about them, you know, Cicero said very similar things, we're saying about them today. Now, I do not believe, because I'm a historian, not an idiot, that the Israelites of the Old Testament have any connection whatsoever, either racially or theologically, with the accountant up the street from me. They have almost nothing in common. Actually, they have nothing in common. The prophets of the Old Testament, as I've said many times, are condemned in the Talmud. Now, that being said, the question is a simple one. Why do Jews hate white people? Jews are not white, of course. I shouldn't have to explain that. I am a firm believer in the Khazar thesis, which I think has been backed by many, and I've had a broadcast on this a couple of years ago. The Russian language DNA studies have actually been pretty conclusive in that regard. Or if you were talking about the Khazars, or you're talking about the Jewish groups from the Middle East and North Africa, none of these people are white. They may look it, but so do many Japanese. They're all over the map in terms of their appearance. Often they look Arabic, but it doesn't matter. Their appearance is irrelevant. They have no connection to anyone other than themselves. And the ancients say this over and over again. There's nothing new here. Now, I wrote this paper, I believe it was 2018, and we were talking about the flood of migrants. And that the purpose of this flood was to destroy European society. The debate, of course, is not whether or not it's meant to destroy Europe, but whether or not it's a good thing. Mass rapes, no-go zones, slavery, social collapse, bankruptcy, rioting are either defended or covered up by the political class and the press. A few years ago, the interior minister, German interior minister, Hans Friedrich, accused Angela Merkel and her media of imposing a news blackout and operating a, quote, code of silence over negative news about these migrants. This might not be news to many of my listeners, but they certainly would be to the mainstream normie. But that's not a matter of opinion. Mass rapes are going unmentioned and even defended in some cases. A couple of years ago, both the police departments in both Oslo and Stockholm have admitted that they have lost control. And of course, that was before COVID and everything else, but it doesn't change anything. It just makes it worse. The migrant invasion, because of everything that's happened in 2020, we've kind of forgotten about it, but it was a curious phenomenon. At no other time has such a huge group of migrants been produced by a civil war in one country. There's been a lot of wars in the Middle East for a very long time, yet this is the only time when millions are pouring into Europe as the ostensible result. The migrants keep coming, despite the fact that that war in Syria has pretty much been done for some time. There are wars all over North Africa, the Middle East, and yet never before has it resulted in this monstrous migration of peoples. By every statistical estimation, almost 90% are men, and most are of military age. That's pretty much all you need to know in that regard. It's being organized and directed. The elites in Europe are seeking to destroy their own civilization at any cost. But how often can you point to, in history, a ruling class of a civilization that deliberately sought the destruction of the area over which they ruled? When you see white people in the streets with signs saying, kill white people, you know how bad the brainwashing is. You know that brainwashing is a reality and mental illness is something that is imposed on these people. Now, of course, the basic point is to import these masses of cheap workers and then to use this dependent reserve army of non-whites to use against any attempt of European states to remove itself from the EU or liberalism or anything like that. The endless tirades of these Islamic invaders claiming that their invasion is precisely to destroy Europe are ignored by the regime's press because they're well aware of this. We all know that Facebook and Twitter has been used to censor any criticism of this movement. Some of you may remember back in 2016, it was September 27th, Merkel and Mark Zuckerberg were caught having a conversation at the UN, and they didn't realize the microphone was on. And we heard, we need to do some work. And he's referring to curtailing anti-immigrant, you know, posts on the refugee crisis. Are you working on this? Merkel asked in English to the head of Facebook. And Zuckerberg replied in the affirmative. And then finally, someone turned off the microphone. Well, we didn't need these slips to tell us what was going on. We all knew that this was the case. But prior to COVID, the German government was seizing private property arbitrarily in order to grant it to the invaders. You know, I've said this many times. For decades, I haven't been overly concerned with the racial elements of the New World Order. But because of things like this, we have no choice but to think in these terms. It's rammed down our throats. More to the point, Jewish groups have been unanimously backing this invasion. In an excellent article in the Occidental Observer, the Jewish Origins of the Open Borders Movement in 2016, they talk about the pseudo-intellectual justification in the academic world of the assault on whites. We read this. In all Western countries, whiteness studies in both academic and social justice expressions remains disproportionately directed by Jews. This is an empirically observable fact. A book could be written on Jewish involvement in the academic discipline alone, end quote. But it should suffice here for a brief survey of some key examples. You know, whiteness studies, you know, it didn't exist, thank God, when I was in college. Anyway, they include Syracuse Barbara Applebaum, who's made a career of advancing the notions of white guilt and ending what she describes as white moral innocence. In a similar vein is Leeds University's Say Bergen, who teaches a course entitled, Why is My Curriculum White? While University of California's George Lipschitz, author of How Racism Takes Place, has also written several books on whiteness and white guilt. Jewish feminist Michelle Fine, based at City University of New York, has produced numerous works on white privilege, including her book, Witnessing Whiteness. Other Jewish academics highly active in the whiteness studies field include Lois Weiss, David Goldberg, Maurice Berger, Lawrence Grossberg, Jennifer Roth Gordon, Cynthia Levine-Rosky, Laura Abrams, Judith Katz, Melissa Stein, Paul Rothenberg, and Amy Eshelman. Obviously, it's not a coincidence. Obviously, it's not a wild roll of the dice. Jews are posing as whites in these cases. So Jewish control over these areas is not a matter of opinion. Neither is the deliberate linkage of the alleged German Holocaust of the Second World War to promote migration. In fact, there's not a single aspect of this migrant invasion, which of course is still going on, which is not under the direct hand of Jewish elites. Jewish author Joe Klein writes in Time magazine, and he's speaking of the real goals of immigration. He says, Trayvon Martin, Trayvon's death is an outrage, but thanks to immigration, stronger laws, and years of hard work, our poisonous biracial era is ending. In other words, by media manipulation of these events, or really the invention of these events, plus the use of non-white invaders, they can destroy any white resistance. Earl Robb, who's a Jewish sociologist, writes this: an increasing ethnic heterogeneity as a result of immigration has made it even more difficult for a political party or a mass movement of bigotry to develop. The Census Bureau has just reported that about half the American population will soon be non-white or non-European, and they will be American citizens. We have tipped beyond the point where a Nazi-Aryan party will be able to prevail in this country. We, referring to the Jews, have been nourishing the American climate of opposition to bigotry for about a half a century. That climate has not yet been perfected, but the heterogeneous nature of our population tends to make it irreversible and makes our constitutional constraints against bigotry more practical than ever. Sometimes it's good, you know, to go back to the basics. What is the sociological problem here? Sometimes when someone simply asks you, well, you know, Jews have done very well in America and Germany, why would they support the left? Why would they seek its own destruction? And it's very good to be able to come up with a rational answer to that. So while cheap labor is always one of the benefits to the elites, as people like Rob and so many others say, the removal of any threat of nationalist rebellion is far more significant. That's their long-term security plan. It's a dangerous one. But powerful people don't get where they are without taking risks. Power, in fact, implies risk. So the elementary question is this: why do Jews dislike whites? I'm referring to groups here, not necessarily individuals. Why? I mean, after all, no other nation is forced to undergo multicultural restructuring like white ones. It's only for white nations. There's no more debate on the racial nature of the media or academia. You know, when you could just list all the names out, there's no question that these are Jewish institutions. When you could list all the names of the owners and major players, the debate is over. All that the system can do is just repress that realization. So, why would Jews loathe whites? The USA has treated Jews wonderfully, and in no other place have Jews been so successful in all other respects. Jews are massively overrepresented in government, and the U.S., of course, is the sole reason that Israel exists. What is going on? Now, I'll list a set of reasons, but I don't mean to imply that there's any order of significance here. For me, the main reason has always been that a racially mixed society is one that has no identity by definition. Rebellion and revolution, real ones, require a firm sense of identity to rise cohesively. Now I'm talking about real one, like Rosin or Pugachev, or Shay's Rebellion in colonial America, not the financed aristocratic movements like the Jacobins or the color revolutionaries. These are well planned by one section of the elite against another. No, I'm talking about real, legitimate, spontaneous revolt against injustice. That requires identity, that requires trust. Mixing races, religions, ethnicities, it destroys the primary ground for actual revolt, or really much of any civic action. Without identity, without this trust, there's no reason to risk your life for someone else. No trust can exist in such a society. It can't be a society at all. At a minimum, any society requires a community that speaks a single language. Now, I mean language in the broadest sense, all manner of communication, not just words. What a shock it is that it actually needs to be argued today. It actually has to be explained. In order for a society to exist, you actually have to speak one language. That has to be explained today. Jews hate Christians. There's no question about this. Most Christians today live in the third world. As of 2010, there are about 2.5 billion Christians of various denominations on the planet. Latin America has 500 million, Africa roughly the same. Christianity is everywhere. Nigeria, Brazil, and Mexico are in the top five countries with the most Christian people. Now, that does not negate the fact that Christianity is a European phenomenon at its root. Until the Reformation, its origins were purely Greek and Latin. German and English came later. Even the missionaries in Asia or Africa were spreading a Latin-based Roman Catholicism. Latin American Christians take their faith, of course, from West Rome. In the East, it's Byzantium. So wherever you go, it is a European phenomenon. And it's been only partly enculturated in other areas never under the Roman Empire. Some of you may remember, I have a lecture, I think more than one, on the fact that Galilee, or Decapolis, and where Christ was born and raised, was Greek. Sepphoris was the main city, of course, and Nazareth was a very small section of it. To be a carpenter and be able to work Nazareth isn't big enough, they actually had to work in Sepphoris, which is a Greek city. Therefore, Greek culture was everywhere Christ went. Calling Jesus a Jew is misleading. It really shows a tremendous ignorance, even use that terminology. It is true that Christ followed the old law in his youth and was educated at the temple. And it's also true that he used the harshest invective against the leadership of the Jews of his day and eventually was murdered by them. During his execution, the temple veil was torn, which, as most of the fathers say, shows the end of the old law for the domination of the pre-Christian era. I don't want to imply there that the Old Testament should be removed. I've made a big deal about saying just the opposite. Christ removed, however, a huge portion of that old law. The prophets are still absolutely binding on everyone. But a few years after the temple veil, the temple itself was destroyed by the same Romans that Christ refused to condemn. Christ condemned most of the Jews of his day, but refused to say a word against the Romans occupying Judea. Greek, not Hebrew, not Aramaic, was the language of the ancient church from Christ's time onward. All manuscripts from this era are in Greek, a bit later in Latin. Sepphoris, as I mentioned, this was not a Jewish city and refused to revolt against Rome during the Jewish rebellion of 66 AD. God does nothing by chance. Christ lived in a heavily Greek area. Sepphoris is Greek. It is well known that Jews returned Christ's invective against them in the Talmud. Christ was a Jew in the same sense that Martin Luther was a Catholic. Now, Jews thrive in chaotic environments. They demand policies that break up the majority group's cohesiveness while building up their own. And this is so well known, at this point, it's beyond debate. And of course, the great expert in this respect is Kevin MacDonald. And he's written, many of you have, you know exactly what I'm talking about, in his Culture of Critique. He famously says this: people in individualist cultures, in contrast, so little emotional attachment to in-groups. Personal goals are paramount, and socialization emphasizes the importance of self-reliance, independence, individual responsibility, and finding yourself. Individualists have more positive attitudes towards strangers and out-group members, and are more likely to behave in a pro-social, altruistic manner to strangers. Because they are less aware of in-group, out-group boundaries, people in an individualist culture are less likely to have negative attitudes towards out-group members. Jews, as a highly cohesive group, have an interest in advocating a completely atomistic, individualistic society in which in-group, out-group distinctions are not salient to Gentiles. Now that, more or less, summarizes the Jewish commitment to some form of liberalism. Within their society, they're quite conservative. For outsiders, since liberalism creates chaos, that's its purpose, they demand liberal policies in both race and family issues. They demand racial mixing for the world, but at the same time, demand a racially pure state in Israel. Harvard University is one of the most corrupt institutions on the planet. Jews predominate. Remember, they're about 2% of the American population, and yet they are 47 times overrepresented compared to whites. They're 20% of the students at Harvard. I'm sorry, excuse me. 20% of the students at Harvard are white males. Ron Unz, who engaged in quite a bit of research on the Ivy League admissions and staff, kind of rejected the common Jewish master race theory that they're simply smarter or more diligent than whites or Asians. They simply network better. Ron Unz did an excellent job. I read his stuff in The American Conservative some years ago. He used the National Merit Scholarship as a base. Using that, Jews are overrepresented at Harvard at a rate about 1,300% that of whites. Another measure is Phi Beta Kappa students, but Jews only make up about 9% of these. Therefore, racial networking is the reason for Jewish dominance, not their inherent superiority. In fact, all merit-based variables show Jews still widely overrepresented without merit. The very fact that Jewish master race theory is even mainstream shows the level of their power. Elena Kagan, before she was installed at the Supreme Court, was dean at Harvard Law. She was appointed there by Jewish President Lawrence Summers. While there, over 50% of her faculty appointments to the law school were Jews. Like it or not, Jewish tribalism dominates the American legal profession, and thus the law. There's no getting out of this. We read in the Express in the UK, "First of all, let it be said that multiculturalism is a euphemism for multiracialism. It was sold to Canadians in a classic bait-and-switch con job as multiculturalism among various cultures of Europe, English, Irish, Scottish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Ukrainian, Greek, etc., but then morphed into the multiracialism we see today." A high IQ white nationalism is a serious threat to Jewish globalism. Jews know that the white race is their only serious competition and has the potential to threaten their Talmudic rule. And they seek the marginalization for the white race, or at least white nationalists, for this very reason. So, Christianity, IQ, the two main reasons for the Jewish hatred of whites. Of course, the third, cheap labor at home. I think many of you have heard when I was fired from one the university that I really truly loved being at and was a blow to my whole life. The only person to defend me was a Jewish professor. So to repeat myself, this isn't about individuals. This is about groups. Two completely different things. But that's exactly the core here. In a divided land, the most cohesive group will rule. If Jews are anything, they have a high level of racial solidarity. And this seems to be both the necessary and sufficient cause of their social dominance. Now, by reducing the white population to a minority, the Jews will be able to control and or eliminate all collective forces not aligned with their own. Now, I know for many of you this is a day-to-day concept, but to get back to the fundamentals, the brass tacks of the matter, this needs to be stated. A typical example here, Jewish push for open borders. And in 1948, David Pogorsky, who was the former director of the American Jewish Congress, says this, and this is right after World War II, "Jewish survival can only take place within the framework of a progressive and expanding democratic society, which through its institutions and public policies gives expression to the concept of cultural pluralism." Few realize that Hitler said this in Mein Kampf. He said, "It was and is the Jews that bring the Negroes into the Rhineland, always with the same secret thought and clear aim of ruining the hated white race by the necessary necessarily resulting bastardization, throwing it down from its cultural and political height, and himself rising to be its master. Hitler had no contempt for Africans whatsoever. If anybody, the people he's talking about did. It's how they're being manipulated. This is a long-standing strategy for a small group to dominate a larger one, bringing in a third party, complete with all kinds of grievances and invented anger, is the easiest means to have a reserve army to use against their opponent. If you are cohesive, but in a tiny minority, this is what you have to do. Some of you also may remember that I'm the only one who spent any time talking about the small Iowa town of Postville. I've mentioned it. I don't think I've done an entire lecture on it. But Postville, for me, was a big deal. This was, years ago, the small town in Iowa welcomed a kosher slaughterhouse, agri-processors. Sholem Lubashkin, who was a member of Chabad, by the way, was the CEO. The story of Postville is a miniature version of the Jewish strategy in general. It's an excellent case study. In fact, is a miniature version. It's a Jewish strategy in miniature. Lubashkin was convicted in 2010 of 89 counts of fraud, yet the local Postville yeshiva was named for him. The abattoir took up residence in Postville, and you know, they used the naivete of locals to make themselves seem harmless. And I can't remember whether I've dealt with this or not, but it's worth repeating if I did. Despite the fact that Postville, Iowa has many employable people, certainly knowledgeable in all kinds of agrarian and ranching areas, they didn't hire them. They brought illegal aliens into their town for the very first time. Sorry about that. That was my phone. I did not put it on airplane. Anyway, some of you know this story. The point of bringing in illegal immigrants into Postville rather than simply hiring locals was not just because they would work for next to nothing, but just in case the locals ever wanted to expel them from the town, they had a reserve army, a crime-prone, angry reserve army to use against them, and they were ruthlessly exploited. And the New York Times was sympathetic to these Jews, and yet they had to admit they were giving maybe $6 an hour. The New York Times said, female workers reported being sexually assaulted by managers, and workplace accidents were not uncommon, including broken bones, eye injuries, hearing loss, and grisly mishaps that resulted in amputations. End quote. Mr. Goldsmith, who was the original owner, said this. That's the ultimate diversity. Consider the Middle East, how broken it is. And here you have a Muslim Somali business right next to an Orthodox Jewish synagogue. In other words, think of the image here. Diversity means Goldsmith can exploit his workers without mercy. The federal government raided the area and was the largest raid against illegal immigrants in American history, I believe. The Jewish Forward, which we're all familiar with, their main newspaper said, of course the raid showed the need for immigration reform so that immigrant workers can come out of the shadows and become a part of the American tapestry. About 400 Guatemalan and Mexican workers were finally deported in an ICE raid on the premises of the Jewish firm. But it gets worse than this. Younger Jews were involved in sales of meth and heroin, creating a drug problem for the first time in that area of Iowa. The thing is, this town and the county wasn't capable of responding to this. They didn't have the resources. God, even PETA talked about the immense cruelty to animals. Of course, being the largest business in town, they had several members on the city council. And of course, the plant received about $1 million in state tax credits. Now, to a great extent, it was a Jewish business and it shielded it from a lot of criticism. But to their credit, CNBC used the slaughterhouse on episode 45 of their American Greed series. The firm was purchased by another Jewish billionaire, Hershey Friedman, in 2009 and changed its name to Agristar. Once the raid eliminated their serf labor, again, rather than use local talent, the Jews imported about 100 Somali migrants to take their place. In public, the new owners said, "We're going to hire local laborers, but no one believed them. Now today, Postville has one of the highest unemployment rates in all of Iowa. And yet, back then, the owners said that we can't find local labor. White people won't do this work. Knowing full well that they were lying through their teeth. At the moment, no, I shouldn't say at the moment, as of a few years ago, there's little economic activity in the town once the processing plant was shut down. About half the town's working population was out of work as of a few years ago. Once the Hispanics and Somalis then fought each other, they formed gangs. They shed blood. Then the rabbis imported a third group from Palau to take their place. The problem is that the rabbis never bothered to tell them how cold it gets in Iowa. They lasted only a short time. They're not exactly used to that in Palau. So what happens? Once the rabbis and their plant left, you had a destroyed town, an army of angry third worlders who immediately turned to crime once the slaughterhouse was gone. Now they make up about 40% of the population. The town itself is largely gone. It's impoverished, crime-ridden, and accused, of course, of all manner of new sins. The Times of Israel, New York Times, says the town is up for grabs. And that article also condemns the authorities for daring to raid a Jewish-dominated area. Today, taxable real estate has lost about 40% of its value. But the plant was also using child labor. An independent investigative team wrote the following. Esteban, who was 16 years old, told us that he worked long 12-hour days cutting cow legs. He showed us a nasty scar on his elbow where he had stabbed himself accidentally while cutting meat. His supervisors at agriprocessors quickly bandaged up his wound and told him to get back to work. He said cuts were common because the line of moving meat went too quickly. But this is how this elite has operated in every town, city, and nation within which they've settled. Not a single newspaper took notice of the fact that local labor was never used in the plant. No one reported on the Jewish involvement in the meth and ice trade in the city. All refused to report on the third worldization of the area and the shocking rise in crime that this created. In miniature, that is the very definition of white genocide. What they did in Postville, they seek to do to the planet. But it gets even worse than this. Ryboshkin was, as I mentioned, sentenced on God knows how many counts. I think I said 89. And he was sent to prison. The press, without fail, said this term was excessive. Local, state, and national press screamed anti-Semitism. And in the local community, hearing this for the first time, they're intellectually unprepared for this and all the accusations. The American Civil Liberties Union, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Washington Legal Foundation all condemned Ryboshkin's trial and sentence as anti-Semitic. Support came from these Amici briefs from pretty much the entire elite of American society, 86 former federal judges and Department of Justice officials, including two FBI directors, four deputy attorneys general, and one solicitor general. National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Washington Legal Foundation, 40 legal ethics professors, Association of Professional Responsibility Lawyers, and the Justice Fellowship. All this to defend the Jewish owner of the agri-processors plant that everyone knows was an actual criminal, is an actual criminal. Then Trump commuted the sentence of Ryboshkin despite his loathing for the Trump administration. The White House said that his commutation was, quote, encouraged by bipartisan leaders from across the political spectrum, from Orrin Hatch to Nancy Pelosi, and was based on expressions of support from members of Congress and a broad cross-section of the legal community. There you have the sheer power of the Jewish elite in America. You had an army of anyone and everyone in the legal profession demanding that Rubashkin's sentence be lowered, or that he shouldn't have been convicted at all, or even tried at all. No one denied his guilt, just that he shouldn't have been punished for it. And when he went back to Brooklyn, he was met with a hero's welcome. Pottsville, just like, you know, America, Pottsville is a miniature version. They were intellectually unprepared for the questions that all this would bring up. They didn't know how to respond to the ritualistic accusations of anti-Semitism or racism the press hurled at them. They were unprepared for Jewish methods of manipulation. They don't know anything about Jewish history. Local law enforcement was unprepared for the sudden increase in crime and racial tension. There is no event in American history that shows a Jewish mind better than Pottsville. And I will keep using that as the example of examples. It is the Jewish mind in miniature. Well, there was there is a much larger version of this exact same process occurring in Western Europe. And we've all heard of the pseudo-intellectual Barbara Spector, who famously stated, "I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be a part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. Europe is not going to be the monolithic society that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role, without that transformation, Europe will not survive." You have to laugh at these kind of things, how this privileged, wealthy Jew lectures Europe on survival. Our people survived the fall of Rome, Ottoman occupation, the Black Death, Napoleon, both world wars, and the Cold War, with no help from the Jews. Charles Silberman wrote in 1985, very good book, "A Certain People, American Jews in Their Lives Today." He said, "American and European-based Jews are committed to cultural tolerance because of their belief, when firmly rooted in history, that Jews are safe only in a society acceptant of a wide range of attitudes and behaviors, as well as a diversity of religious and ethnic groups. It is this belief, for example, not approval of homosexuality, that leads to an overwhelming majority of American Jews to endorse gay rights and to take a liberal stance on most other so-called social issues." Generally speaking, Jews are self-obsessive, writing book after book after book about themselves, always from a position of utter dominance and privilege. I mentioned Earl Robb, the executive director, emeritus, actually, of the Perlmutter Institute of Jewish Advocacy, an associate of the ADL, writer for the San Francisco Jewish Bulletin, says, "It was only after World War II that immigration law was drastically changed to eliminate such discrimination. And one of the first pieces of evidence of its political coming of age, the Jewish community has a leadership role in effecting those changes." Then, of course, he goes on to say that he goes on to celebrate the coming minority status of whites. And he actually uses a phrase, you've already heard me mention it before from him, constitutional constraints on bigotry. Bigotry, of course, is just any attempt from a non-Jew for the sake of survival. Rob says, "The Census Bureau has just reported that about half the American population will soon be non-white or non-European." Right, I mentioned that already. That Rob is talking about the nature of the distinction between what immigration really is all about. I mean, cheap labor is a big part of it. But understand, it's about making certain that white people can never come to defend themselves. He says, "Arab migration has been the best thing that's happened to Europe in the last 50 years. Arabs in Europe are a fact of life. It's time we started to accept that there's no way to block the migration of Chinese, Pakistanis, or Arabs to Europe, It's true. Europe won't be what it once was, but that's a good thing. The more migrants from Africa and Asia who arrive, the better off Europe will be. Sooner or later, their children and grandchildren will marry into veteran European families and change the demographics of their countries. Europe will be different. And that quote is from also was cited in the Occidental Observer article from 2013. But it's an odd way to put it, right? Why is it impossible to stop this flood? Is it an admission of Jewish absolute power? Then he says, for perhaps another generation, an optimistic forecast, the Jewish community will be in a position where it will be in a position to divide and conquer and enter into selective conditions to support our agendas, says Stephen Steinlight. Steinlight, who writes in CIS.org, in the same article, he laments that increasing non-white immigration would lead to a diminution of Jewish power, though. Now, Steinlight is one of these Jews that has some problems with these immigration numbers. In other words, he acts like they win either way. He says, the more non-whites, especially Arabs coming into America and Europe, the less Jews may rule. Steinlight's article should be read because it shows that Jewish migration policies might be opposed by Jews for their own interests. Now, Steinlight's ideas are the fringe of Jewish thinking and probably exist for the Goyim to say, see, they're not all like that. As if we're talking about all, which is nonsensical. Steinlight writes for CIS is very good. I've quoted from them many times before. But of course, in his rejection of migration, again, you give these Jews a handful of kind of neocon Jews who are opposed to this mass migration. But listen to how he opposes it. Not far down the list of awful consequences, our unspoken acquiescence leaves the anti-determinist camp with some notable exceptions, such as the thoughtful and moderate Center for Immigration Studies, largely in the hands of classic anti-immigrant, xenophobic, and racist nativist forces, the white Christian supremacists who have historically opposed either all immigration or all non-European immigration, a position reasserted by Peter Brimlow, must not be permitted to play a prominent role in the debate over the way America responds to the unprecedented demographic change. Nor should the anti-immigrant demagoguery of some black leaders be permitted to go unchallenged. To allow this opens the door to inter-ethnic conflict and a potential white ethnic and black backlash of unimaginable proportions, including a potentially large, violent component, especially if the economy continues to sour, joblessness rises sharply, and anti-immigrant attitudes harden. Now, this is supposed to be one of the good guys, a Jew who's opposed to this massive migrant movement, Steinlight. But this is how he puts it. Anti-immigration ideas promote Jewish power, in his mind, because the arrivals of those men not brainwashed by Holocaust propaganda will be very hard to control. It's odd that he mentions Christian supremacists. It's a very obvious thing. It's almost like he's saying, if you want some Jewish respectability, make sure your views are about Jewish interests. The state must be used to forbid Christian supremacism, which is a platform in this debate. It must not be permitted. It can only be a reference to the state, or at least powerful Jewish-owned media capital. It's everywhere. It's often very common when you're talking about Jews on the, they're on the far left, overwhelmingly. Donald Trump continues to try to get them on his side, despite their loathing of him. The idiot will trot out the occasional guy like Steinlight. There's been a few very good ones over the years. Jews have created some pretty good paleo-conservative intellectuals. I've got no problem with that. But they always state things in a very eccentric way. No matter what they support, Christian supremacism must be rejected. So anti-immigration is okay so long as that's not the motive for it. Therefore, that feeds exactly into what I've said before. at the loathing of Christianity, the worry of high IQ whites being promoted, and of course, cheap labor. These are the reasons for their concern. Daniel Bendit, who was the Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who, you know, many of you may know, the Jewish communist and co-president of the European Greens, European Free Alliance, and the European Parliament. He says, "We, the Greens, have to make sure to get as many immigrants as possible into Germany. If they are in Germany, we must fight for their right to vote. When we reach that, we will have a share of the vote. We need to change this republic." Now, I mean, that's very crude. Just pour people into the country so that they'll vote for us, because we'll cater to them. But it's far worse than that. Many of you know that I have been extremely critical of the U.S. military establishment. That is also official doctrine of the U.S. military. It says, and their own work says, in the modern Europe, that's, you know, obviously an error, in the modern Europe, there is no room for homogeneous national state. It was an idea from 1800s, and we are going to carry it through. We are going to create multi-ethnic states. Many of you are probably aware of who said that, and that was Wesley Clark. In the modern Europe, it was an idea from 1800s. It's almost like, you know, but this is official American military doctrine. He's not speaking just for himself. Rabbi Baruch Efrati says, I've seen this on ynetnews.com, "Jews should rejoice at the fact that Christian Europe is losing its identity as a punishment for what it did to us for the hundreds of years we were in exile there. We will never forgive Europe's Christians for slaughtering millions of our children, women, and elderly. Not just in the recent Holocaust, but throughout the generations, in a consistent manner which characterizes all factions of hypocritical Christianity. And now, Europe is losing its identity in favor of another people and another religion. And there'll be no remnants and survivors from the impurity of Christianity, which had a lot of blood it won't be able to atone for. Even if we are in a major war with the region's Arabs over the land of Israel, Islam is still much better as a Gentile culture than Christianity. Jews must pray that the Islamicization of most of Europe will not harm the people of Israel." There's nothing strange about this. There's nothing, you know, eccentric about this. This is the overwhelming Jewish opinion expressed in article after article, paper after paper, journal after journal. You know, the childish historical illiteracy taught in elite universities, of course, isn't history. It's ethnic-based propaganda. Again, this isn't a fringe idea. Almost all Jews are atheists from a religious point of view. Judaism is an ethnic group and has not been a religion in centuries. Synagogues are not houses of worship, since worship among the handful of religious Jews left in the world can only really be performed at the Temple of Jerusalem, destroyed in AD 70. The synagogue really is just a political and ideological mobilization center. It's nothing else. Richard Edmondson wrote the following on the Jewish mind in 2017. "Jews regard themselves as chosen. This view of themselves as chosen is probably given added fuel by the fact that Jews dominate the banking and finance and media entertainment sectors. Domination in these two sectors gives them, by way of extension, control over politicians. Never before in history has one tiny ethnic group found itself with so much power. Jews, the ethnic group in question, obsess in a psychologically unhealthy manner over the Holocaust. Obsessing over the Holocaust can give rise to other pathologies, including the inability to self-reflect and the tendency to see oneself as the eternal victim. Jews in Europe and America have promoted wars to benefit Israel. The power of the media to demonize this or that foreign leader, regardless of facts, make it relatively easy for them to get such wars started. The foreign leaders are generally accused of killing their own people. The wars are then fought to kill in large numbers for the very same people the Jews initially expressed us concern for. Jews in Europe and America, by and large, advocate multiculturalism. In this, they receive sympathetic support from the media, the same media that portray as racist politicians who call for any limits on immigration. By contrast, the media, owned by the same owners who support multiculturalism in the West, also support Israel, a country with elected leaders who are openly racist and whose policies are precisely the opposite of multiculturalism. Rising anti-Semitism among the public is an inevitable reaction to Jewish power and hypocrisy and contradictions, and there are often destructive results in Jewish behavior. And that comes from his Fig Trees and Vineyards from 2017. Much of this is not a matter of opinion. It's very easy to show the list of names of who controls what. They're 2% of the American population. They're roughly 0.5% of the Russian population. Anyone pretending to lecture on American politics and not knowing this fact needs to resign. It proves that anybody who talks without mentioning this is too ignorant to teach anyone anything on this topic. To speak of American politics without mentioning Jewish power is like lecturing on the history of organized crime and not mentioning Meyer Lansky. Yet this essential key aspect of American life is almost entirely unknown by precisely those whose job it is to dig into this power structure. Black author Dontell Jackson, some of you have heard of him, has written the following in his book, We Thought They Were White. Behind every single black rights organization, the Jews have been there from the very beginning, pulling the strings. From the NAACP, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, SCLC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Jews such as Joel Spingarn, Lillian Vold, Rabbi Emil Hirsch, Stephen Wise, Henry Moskowitz in 1909, together with black leaders such as W.B. Du Bois, to form the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. 1 year later, another prominent Jewish and black leader created the Urban League. Jews made substantial financial contributions to many civil rights organizations, including the NAACP, Urban League, etc. Kibbe Kaplan, the vice chairman of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, now the Union for Reform Judaism, served as the national president of the NAACP from 1966 to 1975. Arnie Aronson worked with Philip Randolph and Roy Wilkins to found the LCCR. From 1910 to 1940, over 2,000 primary and secondary schools and 20 black colleges, including Howard, Dillard, and Fisk universities, were erected in whole or part contributions from the Jewish philanthropist Julius Rosenwald. At the height of the so-called Rosenwald schools, nearly 40% of Southern blacks were educated at one of these institutions. Today, the reason for this now is known, few in number. Jews have become masters of divide and rule. Finland has about 400 Jews, but the major newspapers are Jewish-owned. Controlling information is a Jewish imperative. It seems bizarre that Jews, a wealthy, dominant elite in the U.S., should then loathe the land that's been so wonderful to it. But answering this mystery is kind of what I've been talking about. To answer that question that we kind of take for granted now. There's certainly more at stake than dollars and cents. The Jewish imperative against Christianity and whites more generally is more important than all of that. Without Christ, Judaism, as it exists today, would disappear tomorrow. Without us, Jews would then be killing each other. We are what holds them together. The Kahal system in old Russia was held together by the belief that if you leave the Kahal system, anti-Semitism will destroy you. The Gentiles are, in fact, animals. Therefore, Jews do, as institutionally speaking, dislike whites, hate whites. What's happened with the make-believe George Floyd case is proof. It was invented by the press and has continued to be supported by the press. The American media, entirely Jewish-owned, has been supporting the burning down of American cities. What used to be something that they would only talk about around the water cooler, now they openly brag about. You can't talk about any of these factors without the Jewish factor. You can't talk about American media control without talking about the Jewish factor. New Khazaria. I've always been of the opinion, a pet theory of mine, is that the state of Israel in the Middle East isn't all that significant. you know, of course, you have the symbolism of Jerusalem. But Israel, in the true secular Jewish sense, is the U.S., especially the American cities and the American universities. They have never been able to rule as openly as they do here. We all know Jews who have rejected this. I know a few. But they're not relevant here. They're not Judaism. They're not Jewish America. They're outliers, to say the very least. People are ignorant. They simply have no idea of where power comes from, of where ideology comes from. It just seems strange. They hate the land that has treated them so well. And then when the reaction comes, they're going to say, see, we told you so, all the Gentiles are animals. Other minorities, in even in medieval Europe, Arabs and Armenians, wealthy, insular, have never been treated this way, have never viewed their hosts this way. Only this one group. You've had many well-off minorities in Europe from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance to the Baroque era, many of them. Persians, who never acted like the Jews did and never got thrown out. We're not talking about individuals here. We're talking about a social movement. We're talking about a social force. We need to be aware of what's happening around us and no longer be afraid of speaking out. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.